Campus FM presents Work in Progress, a series of seminars and symposia on understanding cultural diversity.
All right, well, good evening, ladies and gentlemen, for tonight's Work in Progress seminar. The title of tonight's symposium is Refugees, Illegals, and Immigrants in Malta. To begin with, let me announce next week's seminar. Next week, I will be speaking. I'll be reading a paper, Why Catholicism Can Understand Islam, Anthropology and Religious Awareness. The paper argues that based upon fieldwork in Africa, there are strong reasons to believe in a deep dialogue between Catholics and Muslims. Tonight, it gives me great pleasure to welcome Father Pierre Grec Margurat, Director of the Jesuit Refugee Service, and Miss Marcia Grima, of the Center, Multi-Center for Restoration. Marcia has conducted research on immigrants. More particularly, she's conducted research on political refugees in Malta. I'm the chairman. My name is Paul Clough from the anthropology program. We were expecting a third speaker. He is ill, and it is unlikely that he will be able to come even at this late moment. So let me hand over to Father Pierre Grec Margurat to open up tonight's symposium. Or does Marcia wish to speak first? Marcia, you wish to speak first?
Maybe.
Fine.
Okay. Right, good evening. So as Dr. Klaus said, I carried out my research on political refugees. The research was carried out in 1999, just before the refugee law came into force. So I'll start by introducing the institutional setup at the time. And basically, I'm going to discuss three themes. The first will discuss refugees as dependents. What sort of dependency did they have on Malta? What did they expect from Malta? What did they receive from Malta? From there, from dependency, I'd like to go on to the second topic, which will discuss degrees of independence. How did they strive for a separate identity to that of refugee? And what sort of decisions they made as refugees? Finally, on the third point, I'd like to discuss responsibility and rights from the part of the host country, but also from the part of refugees. And the interlinking factor between these will be resources. How do resources get to them? How do they manage these resources? So that I'm going to introduce. So refugees as dependents. Institutions set up in 1999, at my time of research, Malta was a signatory to the conventions to grant asylum to asylum seekers, but had made a number of reservations due to Malta's size and limited resources. Refugees, firstly, were not allowed to settle permanently in Malta, and Malta was only to serve as a transit point before they go on to resettlement. Although they were allowed to reside in Malta for however long that would take, they were not permitted to work in Malta. And this was to have a major determining force on what, on the sort of life they could expect in Malta. The government also committed itself to providing medical attention and free education. It was therefore taken that refugees would be in Malta for a brief period. However, in practice, their stay offer extended into years, some staying here for 5 years and even over. The representative of the international body, or the UNHCR, was church-run organization, the Emigrants Commission. The applications for refugee status were processed through the Commission, and also any funds from the UNHCR which go to refugees were processed through the Commission. The UNHCR did provide £90 per month to refugees initially for the first 6 months of their stay, but then this would be halved and they would stop altogether at the end of 2 years. So ultimately they now had no funds as refugees coming in, and they had no funds which they could legally get through work. So how did they survive in Malta? The Immigrants Commission basically took responsibility for the refugees' well-being at the time. There were also a number of other organisations like the Jesuit Refugee Service and other church organisations which helped refugees with basic necessities like food, accommodation and so forth. The Commission, as such, provided accommodation, some through the church. I had carried out research on a specific accommodation, specific residence, which I referred to in my thesis as St. Joseph's. But also there were benefactors who provided flats at a low rent to families. They distributed funds, £1 a day, to the most needy, food and clothes, and also, unofficially, they provided work to the refugees. Basically, employers would get in touch with the Commission and say that they had work which generally was seasonal, such as agriculture or in the construction industry. So some self-sufficiency was rather encouraged, but they were very vulnerable since all of this was done underhand. So now I'll go into my research as such, which was on the refugees living at St. Joseph's home. Okay, so this home was a home for male refugees. Their ages were from around 18 to age 40, with most of them being young men in their 20s. The number of residents varied from around 20 to 30, and so occasionally they'd have to share rooms. There was an attempt that Muslims would share with Muslims and Christians with Christians, but this wasn't always possible. So you can imagine some of the conflicts which would arise, like using the frying pans or sharing pans, when Muslims won't eat pork and Christians do. So even on small things, sometimes you'd get some conflict. Why did I choose St. Joseph's as my case study? Mainly because it offered me the opportunity to go beyond interviewing, simply visiting somebody at home and then going back home. But I could hang out there and observe the refugees' behaviour and their interaction with one another and also with the persons aiding them. I basically hang out in the kitchen with the person who ran St. Joseph's, whose name was Sister Rose. She's a nun in her 70s, and basically she took responsibility for cooking there, cleaning, and making sure that resources got to them. Sister Rose, she cooked one meal a day for those who chose to eat in the kitchen. She distributed rice, sugar, pasta, salt, detergent, and all this was done from the kitchen. So this was the central focus of a lot of what I observed. And sometimes she'd give them some money to go to buy bread, but money she'd keep to just a few cents to make sure it would go towards food and not something else. She distributed clothes, but after filtering out torn clothing or women's clothing, so people would make donations but not necessarily knowing specifically to who they were giving. She tried to keep the residents tidy, but often complained at how messy the refugees were, and that she rarely was receiving help. Only one really gave her much help, and he had been out of work with a neck injury for over a year, but and had become increasingly attached to her. There was no phone at the residence, so she'd receive all phone calls coming from outside, including from potential employers. Sister Rose instructed benefactors not to give refugees money directly, or else they'd spend it on capricci, basically capricious things, like cigarettes, alcohol, or going to Parcheville. And she felt that the money should go towards basic necessities, such as food. Some of the refugees referred to her as mother, and she often took on this role rather willingly. And she'd counsel them, and even those who escaped from the island would even write to her later. So she was quite a formidable old lady, but always carrying around, always busy. But at the same time, she gets frustrated. And they knew this, so there was a bit of tension in the relationship at the same time. She'd sometimes excuse their capricci on their age. She'd say, they are young portings. Of course they want to meet people their age. And that's true. As a researcher, I found some of the behaviour of the refugees at the home confusing and sometimes frustrating. Why didn't they take better care of the home? If they needed charity, how could they spend it on capricci? Charity is for necessity, so how can you waste charity or spend it on something which isn't a necessity? There used to be what seemed like a lack of gratitude also towards those who held them at the commission and the home. Indeed, rather than gratitude towards the commission, they rather more expressed distrust that the commission was withholding funds, not processing their applications, that the head of the commission, the Monsignor, held a grudge towards them. And indeed, they blamed the commission and the Maltese authorities for having to rely on charity in the first place, exclaiming that they were young and capable if given a chance. So this kind of summarizes their situation of dependency in Malta. And with that, I want to go to my second theme, which is how they try to attain some degree of independence as refugees and make decisions in their own lives. So if we look back at this slide, we can see that their time in the home varied from years to sometimes just a few months, sometimes as little as 2 months. There are some who were there for 3 years, but they'd be coming in and out. They'd find work, they'd work for a while, but then as soon as they come on hard times, they'd find themselves back at the residence. So, and there were also people who didn't live at the residence as soon as they arrived in Malta, but again, they'd find themselves at the residence as soon as they fall on hard times. For example, one Algerian had arrived in Malta, and he said he had come here on a legal visa, posing as an agent, having to pick up goods in Malta, then outstayed his visa. He found a job, rented a flat, and applied for refugee status. However, the nature of refugee work is often sporadic and ill-paid. This particular Algerian had occasionally worked for 50 cents an hour and had shifts which stretched to 15 hours with another employer. I knew of cases when he didn't get paid and even when he did actually get injured at work. For example, not wearing a mask once he had like swollen eyes. He was always generally in employment, but he only managed to move out of the residence during my study for 2 months, and then again he was back there. He did manage to save enough to have his own car, which was second hand, and a mobile phone. So to an extent he did retain some independence, but not enough to live outside the home. Abuses from employers could be avoided with work which came to the commission, but one had to accept whatever the commission found. Further to this, refugees wouldn't necessarily be paid directly by the employer, but wage would come in the form of a donation to the commission, and the commission would distribute the wages. Some refugees try to make it on their own steam. And I want to discuss one refugee who was quite successful in doing this on his own. And then I'll highlight some of his rhetoric. So basically, this is how he told me his story. And that's how I'm going to say it. But there are things where there might be certain discrepancies or whatever, but that's part of how he narrated it. So I'm going to talk about a Sudanese. I refer to him as Simon, who was 32 years old, and he arrived in Malta with $300. For the interview, he said he'd take me out for lunch, which he did. And basically, his story was that he arrived from Libya with other Sudanese. He claims to have been the first Sudanese to rent his own place in Malta. When I asked how he managed this, he responded, "Human relations are very important. I know how to socialize better than the others." He was university educated and very good English. On arrival, he claimed he had arrived with some other Sudanese, but they were detained by the police, and he managed to sneak away with another group that had arrived from Egypt. He then said that he took a taxi to a private hospital. I asked him why a hospital. He said, "So the police couldn't accuse me of running away. I'd say that I needed a doctor." So it demonstrates a certain know-how in this chap. The hospital allowed him to make a phone call, and he phoned a Sudanese friend who already lived in Malta, and this friend took him to St. Joseph's. Simon stayed at the home for 5 days without the sister knowing. He finally approached her, and she instructed him to go to Dar el-Emigrant. He claims that the commission gave him a hard time to accept his application for refugee status, and they must have written something against him, since it took almost a year for him to receive refugee status. He said that he was not welcome at St. Joseph's by the commission, so he found his own place. His first job was in construction. He found a job indirectly through the commission. The monsignor at the commission had given papers to two Sudanese so that the firm would give them work. He accompanied them without a paper from the monsignor and still managed to get hired. But the checks paying them for the work were sent to the monsignor. He protested that he had worked for the company and not for the commission, but they told him that he'd have to receive his wages from the commission. Basically, this protected the employer from getting charged by the authorities, because everything was donations. The other two Sudanese received their checks from the secretary, but she informed him that his was with the monsignor who ran Dar el-Emigrant. He said, "I used my head. I told Mons that I would have come for the relief money of £1 per day, but since I had a job, I wouldn't need it. So all I needed was to collect my work check." And Mons said, "Yes, yes, of course." He didn't have any trouble collecting future checks from the secretary. He later worked as a dishwasher at a hotel. He also claimed to have befriended a different hotel owner at a bar and got an office job with him. However, he said that he stayed for less than a month because he couldn't put up with the owner bragging loudly how he was giving work to a black refugee. When I met Simon, he was working at a supermarket, had got the job with the help of an Irish Maltese lady friend who knew the owner's sister. She had told the owner's sister that he was her fiancé and needed work. He got an interview with the owner who hired him, and Simon described him as a very good man. So basically, he worked with him for over a year. And he was still working there until he got through the interviews for the United States, where he's been resettled since then. He only moved back to St. Joseph's during the last 2 months of his stay in Malta. I remarked, "Is this in order to save money before you move on?" But he claimed that he had never had any trouble earning money. His only asset on leaving Malta was his Lambretta, which he offered to sell to me for 250 Maltese lire. A week later, after I had left, I bumped into an Angolan from the residence, and he told me he had bought Simon's bike for 300 Maltese lire. So, what can we draw from Simon's discourse about his stay in Malta? His greatest investment, he invested a lot of energy in contacts. He had contacts with Sudanese, and through that he got to know about residents. Then with Maltese, and through Maltese he got work in some cases. So human relations, he placed as key to his maintaining some independence, and this was very important for him. He said that in Bujibba I am Simon, but I would never invite friends over to St. Joseph's. So even living at the home, he remarked as a step back in human relations, which were so crucial to his maintaining a separate identity to that of refugee. One also detects a certain bravado to his talk. There's always this struggle with the Emigrants Commission, although they distribute resources, he expresses a certain defiance, and that otherwise he'd be having to submit to them in accepting willingly work, accommodation, and whatever other resources they distributed. These two elements of trying to strive for independence and this tone of defiance was common to all the refugees I met at St. Joseph's. And this brings me to the last part of my presentation, where I want to talk briefly about responsibilities from the organisations who help and the host country and from the refugees' part. Since when we talk about rights, we also imply responsibilities. I think it's important that we recognise when we're looking at refugees that they're actors as well. So they're not simply receiving, and we need to go beyond the labels we give them as refugees. If way of defining them as refugees and labelling them is that resources were given to them as refugees. They were given basic necessities in the form of charity. And I found that charity does not instill a sense of gratitude. They received food, clothes, basic accommodation, but the refugees felt that they had been reduced to relying on such basic necessities. You had people arrived in Malta, in one case, not from the residents, but there was one Iraqi family who arrived with around $10,000, and that lasted for them for around a year. Then for the other 5 years they were here, basically they had to rely on help in receiving accommodation, and the man worked, but always with help from the authorities. Their lack of appreciation was an expression of their feeling reduced. Most of them expressed dissatisfaction in living at the home. Some mockingly called it the hotel. And one refugee got scolded by his sister Rose for writing reception on the kitchen door. To quote Viner, reciprocity as a principle of exchange is not simply about giving while receiving, but it's a series of disguised strategies of power relations that she describes as keeping while giving. So we were willing to give refugees food, very basic accommodation, clothes or whatever. However, ultimately the message was, this is not your land. The jobs are for Maltese and homes are for Maltese. Go home or move on. Basically, the message was, you're not welcome. Furthermore, with charity, I found that it did not instill a sense of responsibility amongst them. The refugees did not use the charity as their benefactors would have expected of them. Rather than fitting the role of poor refugees, they rebelled against this identity, and rather put charity to use for their own aims. We mentioned previously how they spent money on Capricci. A closer look at their expenditure would reveal that they were spending money on cigarettes, drinking, Parcheville. Some bought their own clothes, and a few of them managed to invest in second-hand cars, and a few had mobiles. During my stay, as we can see there, only two managed to actually move out and rent their own place. I believe that these were all strategies towards maintaining a separate identity to the home. They all made whatever feeble attempts towards asserting some independence and establishing lives outside the refugee network. Such networks were central to attaining resources such as work, but also maintaining a semblance of normality. These were feeble attempts at asserting some independence and establishing lives outside the refugee network. The networks they were interested in were ones where they could attain resources such as work, as we saw in Simon's case, and also maintaining a semblance of normality. One of the greatest regrets was what a waste of time their time in Malta was. They saved little, they could not settle here unless they married a Maltese, and that was always a possibility, which they always maintained. Finally, since their vulnerability prevented them attaining self-sufficiency, it also meant that the blame for any misdeeds could also be lain on somebody else, whether the Commission or the Maltese authorities. So basically, without rights, refugees could not become social beings with responsibilities, and including over their own lives. Blame for those who did anything wrong was that we reduced to this. This is what they brought us to. So to an extent, there's a high degree of waste, and their resourcefulness, rather than being directed towards multi-society, was more directed towards their own strategies and needs, which basically was a waste for them and ultimately also for Malta. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Marcia, for what was not just a very interesting report, but also, I think, a very interesting analysis. Now I'd like to hand over to Father Pierre Grec Margurat.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure to listen to Marcia, because at the time when she was doing her research, we often talked about what was going on. And she talks a lot about the lack of rights. At least things have changed since then, at least partially. Let's say partially. We now have a law. And the law didn't come about because the minister dreamt of the laws, he often claims. But the law came about because as soon as we had our first acquis, the acquis communautaire towards the entry into the EU, one of the things that was noted in that acquis communautaire was that Malta didn't have a refugee law. I remember writing an article the following day which said, a refugee law when? And the following morning I got a call from the ministry asking us if we would go over to discuss the issue. We had already been working on a policy paper on the issue of what we thought should be in refugee law, what are the rights that should be present in any refugee law at the time. And since then we have a law. We're not totally happy with the law that we have. There were criticisms that we made when the law did come, was enacted in October 2000 and came into force in 2001. But at least we do have a law. Before that, as Marcia was saying, all claims for refugee status had to go via, had to be examined in Malta, but then had to go to Rome to be examined by UNHCR in Rome. And that meant perhaps a much longer process. That meant as well a process that was not carried out in Malta, which was far away from us and not always easy to follow up what was happening, to the extent that people sometimes waited a number of years before they got the status. Things have changed since then. Since then, we are far more preoccupied about something that did not happen at the time. At the time, anybody arriving in Malta claiming refugee status lodged his claim for status, but was left to live in the community. As Marcia was saying, she could visit them in the house, and this we weren't talking of just a few persons. Over in the beginning of 91, 92, we had 900 persons arriving from Iraq, because of the time when the first Gulf War started, the consul in Iraq was granting visas to persons who wanted to come to Malta, and he had managed to grant 1,000 visas before he was stopped, before they realized in Malta that he was granting so many visas. And at the time, 900 persons arrived with the families, and I remember they were distributed in various areas on the island, and they did manage to integrate at the time. They did live here for a number of years till they got status and then decided to move on. Most of them did move on to another country because they had family in Sweden or in Canada or in Australia or in the USA. And many moved on also to the services of the Emigrants Commission via church sponsorship through Monsignor Calvea's services with the churches over there. But it is a fact that we did have a very large number of persons who were coming from, who were Iraqis, and also from the war in Bosnia. Perhaps, I don't know, I wouldn't like to say this, but perhaps the fact that they were not black made their integration far easier in Maltese society. Whether we like it or not, we have to start thinking very seriously about the question of racism. What is the situation now? Since 2001, the government decided on a detention policy when people started to arrive by boat from the northern coast of Africa. Most of these persons nowadays arrive via Libya. It is quite well known that Libya doesn't have any control on its borders and is not interested, it seems, in controlling its borders. Italy has readmission agreements with most of the countries of northern Africa, including Albania, as well as Albania and Turkey. So anybody arriving to Italy could be sent back unless he has a claim for refugee status. And the only route suddenly that became the most easy route was the route via from Libya towards Italy, because most of these persons intended, all of these persons intended to go to Italy. And of course there is also a bit of the myth of the El Dorado, of the paradise, which is Europe. In 2001, we had the first boatload of 57 persons who arrived, 57 Sudanese, in November, and the government decided on to detain these persons. Between March of 2002 and the end of 2002, we had a total of over 1,754 persons who arrived by boat in different boatloads. There were two large boatloads which arrived, one on the 3rd of March, actually. We are celebrating today, actually, the second anniversary since their arrival. And of those persons, today we can say that those who arrived on the 3rd of March have all been freed, but of course with a lot of pain, because they had been detained. Most of them were detained till last December, the 23rd of December 2004. So most of them were detained for well over 18 months, 19 months. We started getting boatloads of people, which included families, children. We had a number of children detained, unaccompanied minors, and a lot of single men. The vast majority were single men and are single men. The policy of detention, I think most of you know that I'm against detention, but I'm against detention not simply for various reasons, but I would like to read out just the first paragraph of here's a representative over here, the lawyer for UNHCR, she knows the more than I do probably, which says, this is a UNHCR document, and besides the UNHCR document, there are several documents which are against detention. Pax Christi has a very good document, ECRE has a document against detention, but UNHCR, being the highest authority probably on refugees in the world, says this about detention. Detention of asylum seekers is, in the view of UNHCR, inherently undesirable. This is even more so in the case of vulnerable groups, such as single women, children, unaccompanied minors, and those with special medical or psychological needs. Freedom from arbitrary detention is a fundamental human right, and the use of detention is, in many instances, contrary to the norms and principles of international law. I would call the persons who arrived irregular migrants rather than legal migrants. Legal migrants gives the impression that they are not meant to be legally amongst us. They are persons who enter the country irregularly. They did not commit any criminal offence, to the effect that the Refugee Convention in Article 31 does state that a person may enter a country without any documents, because a refugee fleeing from a country where he or she is fleeing her own government who's oppressing her, or his government who's oppressing him, or is fleeing because of religious, because of ethnic reasons, will not go the way we would go to the passport office in Valletta and ask for a passport, because that would be his own condemnation. So it is quite logical that a person can enter a country without documents, as long as the person and then does go to the authorities and ask for asylum. What happened, the government decided on a policy that these persons who were picked up in territorial waters were immediately detained. They had no other ways of resorting not to be detained. And the detention, I will not talk too much about the conditions of detention, because most of us know about them now after the Gil Robles report. And if you haven't read it, I would suggest that you read it, because it's a very enlightening document. It's an 11-page document. It's not that long. But it does talk about, this is a report, for those of you who don't know about, which was carried out by the High Commissioner for Human Rights for the Council of Europe, Alvaro Gil Robles, who came to Malta in October and paid a visit on the 21st, 22nd of October of last year, and issued this report. This report was issued on the 9th of February of this year. But it is far more damning than the reports that we did read in the newspapers. We did read reports which seemed to say, in some newspapers at least, not all of them, that it's okay, it's quite okay. But actually, it's quite damning as regards to detention, to the conditions of detention, to how long people are detained, to how they are detained, to the amount of time they have every day to recreate themselves, to the question of schooling of children. I was assigned initially to help towards the schooling of children. It took 6 to 8 months before the first child went to school. Simply for bureaucratic reasons, simply because nobody would take responsibility for things like a medical certificate for the children. We had a lot of complaints initially from the Maltese public. We had complaints on television. We had complaints in schools. And I think this enlightens us a bit to the question of how do we look at these people? And I think Marcia is very correct when she says the discourse based on charity and not on rights can do a lot of harm to these people. Can do a lot of harm simply because we seem to think, I think this is my impression, but I think I'm not completely incorrect, that these people have lesser rights than we have. And this is also due to the fact of detention. Detention has inculcated into the minds of persons the idea that if they are there, they must have done something wrong. We only, in society, we only send to prison persons who have done something wrong. You know, we say, okay, he stole, so he's in prison. He killed, he's in prison. And we have a limited compassion for these people, because we say they're just paying, just paying for what he robbed society of, or what he did against society. Whilst these people have been detained for doing nothing of the sort. So we have inculcated in people's minds. I had somebody ask me last week, he told me, "Well, Father, I'm sure there are quite a few terrorists around the month." And I said, "I never met one." But he said, "They must be criminal at least." "No," I said, "I never met one." I'm not saying they're angels. They're human beings. They're human beings the way we are human beings, and the way you will find in society people who are honest and people who are crooks. There are many crooks around who are not in prison. But I think this has been really well anchored now into the Maltese imagination that these people are somehow, we have pictured them that way. And we have done quite a few things to help them be pictured that way. The fact that they go to hospital handcuffed, the fact that they are accompanied by two, three soldiers each time you have one person hospital. I remember once a woman who was feeling very sick, being taken to the polyclinic. I saw her leave I was in the detention center, and I saw her being brought back, and she was accompanied by three or four soldiers. And you would say, gosh, you know, and she was in real pain. This either makes you think, you know, it's gone well beyond. I mean, I've had the police commissioner who's complaining that for every detainee, he needs five policemen to take care of that person, because if that person has to go to hospital, he has to have round the clock over a day. He needs five persons to guard that person. So five policemen, which means as well, he said, and he said this in public, that he has to close a police station in one of the villages, because there is a problem. I mean, I would like to show also that detention, notwithstanding besides the harmful effects, and besides the fact that there is no real to be founded reason for detaining these people, we have to find alternatives definitely to detention, and there are possibilities, and there are documents which talk about alternatives to detention. Besides that, detention is a highly costly affair. In a study that was carried out in South Bank University, they found out that this is the most costly way of keeping asylum seekers. If Britain were to adopt a policy of detention, they would be detaining 93,000 persons. That is the number they had in 2003. They are trying to reduce, and they're trying to reduce the number by half, and they seem to be managing. But Britain only detains 845 persons. That's how many they had in detention, which is far less than we had in detention. So I think there are many aspects to the question of detention, besides not considering the psychological effects of detention. We don't know the harmful effects done to the persons who have been detained, for the simple reason that we don't have people who are qualified. We don't have people who are qualified in post-traumatic stress disorder, first and foremost. We've had cases, we have a number of cases of people who have been sent to Mount Carmel. We've had problems, they've caused problems even in the system because of the nurses not being in a situation as well to cope with these persons, because they find it very difficult to help them. There are cultural problems, there are linguistic problems, there are counseling problems. In the detention center, there were no services at all other than just being fed. That's what people were given, food. There was no medical service. We had asked very often for a medical service, so eventually people were taken all the time to hospital. There are still people in detention. I'm speaking as if it were in the past, because most of the people who were in detention have now been either granted some form of status, that is either refugee status, but most of them have been granted humanitarian status, or else have been repatriated. There are still persons in detention. There are around 240 persons in detention, or slightly less. And there are still questions both about the conditions of detention. They are slightly better now because they are far less crowded. At this time last year, we had people living in tents in Halsafi. There were people living in a hunger which was described by Alvaro Gil Robles, something like a freezer in winter and the microwave in summer, and very poor sanitary conditions with very, very few toilets and very poor conditions. We also must say that the number of NGOs who work with refugees and detainees is very small in Malta, and the resources are very limited. We work mostly with volunteers, so it's not easy to cope with such large numbers, either for the NGOs or for the authorities. We never claimed that the authorities had an easy job. I think that the, the police and the soldiers had a very difficult job because they were no way trained to deal with persons. They were no way trained to deal with these persons who were in detention. I do not know if I want to continue. I nearly would like to stop there. I've given an idea of what we've been trying to cope with. We've done two publications which are available for anybody who's interested. I think I've distributed them to most of the persons. One was to try and raise public awareness as to the question of detention. And these are the stories of people who were held in detention locally and a few ideas about what we think about detention. The other is a legal study as to the illegality of detention, which we are claiming, which was done by our lawyer and other lawyers who helped her out. I think we have to reflect very seriously about this question. It is quite, I think it's not realistic to imagine that because we've had a lull in persons arriving over the last few months, that things will remain that way. Once we enter into the EU, things will even change because Malta might become a destination. We do not know. Nobody knows what, how persons in Africa will look at our entry into the EU. They might see Malta as a possibility of getting a step into the EU and then come to Malta. What has been happening now is that most of the persons who are freed, one, have a very bad experience of Malta. We find it difficult to imagine. People say things like, oh, we're feeding them. They should be grateful. Yes, I don't know if you'd be very happy if you were fed in a cage, but anyway. And these people have had a very bad experience, so most of them would like to move. But they're also being, I think, pushed to move, being told there's no place for you, public opinion is saying, oh, this is a highly overpopulated, it is truly a densely populated island, but there are other sides to this question. It's very, it would be very interesting to know how many persons, not refugees or asylum seekers, are currently working on this island illegally. And there are numbers from what I can hear. Unfortunately, you have no research to back that, but there could be thousands. And on the one hand, we're saying, and this is also a bit the policy of Europe, which is a bit hypocritical, saying that European countries don't have space for people to migrate into them. On the other hand, if you look at economic studies, the Economist carried out a study called The Longest Journey about people traveling from Africa, where they really pushed the idea that these people should be integrated into society because Europe is a graying continent and with a very, very high need of labor. So the director of the Central Bank of Italy, Fazio, in an address which he made more than once, said, Italy needs labor. Italy needs 93,000 persons a year into the labor market. Spain needs 64,000 persons a year into the labor market, fresh persons, or else they will be unable to keep up their pensions and to keep up the social security systems. So on the one hand, from the politicians, we hear a discourse which is where the question of refugees, migrants, is often used as a scapegoat issue. It's been used in Denmark, it's been used in Belgium, it's been used in Austria, it's been used in quite a few places with Le Pen in France, in Holland. So it's an issue which is very easy to use, and perhaps the worst example, and an example that even the Maltese government has often quoted, is Australia. Australia has a very bad record and has given the world a very bad example as regards to detention, because they are the country who... this was told to us very clearly by people who are even from UNHCR. Australia has probably one of the worst records, and we're kind of following in those footsteps with regards to detention. So I think it's a very wide discourse. There's the question of migration, which in a way is separate, but also influences this issue. There's the question of rights, the rights of these people, what are their rights, what are the rights we owe them because they are human beings with the same rights that we have. There's the question of what to do, which is a pragmatic question. If we do not have space for them on this island, then there are other alleys and other routes to take, and this is part of being in the international community. And we have to accept that we have to share part of the burden of this world. It's useless to say, well, Malta is too small or Malta cannot do this, that. These people are here. We have to face them. We have to live with them. We have to live with them is not in the sense of tolerate them. We are called to live with them, and to treat them with the dignity that they deserve as persons. It's a very complex discourse, perhaps, but I think we have to elaborate far more this complex discourse and reflect seriously of what it means as well to us as a multicultural society. We do want to be part of the world, but we tend to not to want to be fully part of the world. There is a kind of this play between wanting and not wanting. I'll stop there and we'll take questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Father Pierre. I want to thank both our speakers. I think what we've seen tonight is a very interesting balance between Father Pierre, who's given us an overall global picture of the refugee problem in Malta, focusing particularly on problems connected with detention, whereas Marcia has taken a close-up look, a close-up anthropological look at one house of refugees. So in a sense, we've been lucky to receive both a global picture and a very minute picture of the refugee situation in Malta. Before asking the audience for questions or discussions, may I briefly point backwards and forwards in the seminar series. Our first speaker on 18th February, Dr. Ruth Faruja of the Law Faculty, also spent some time analyzing the detention problem. And what I see as a parallel feature in both her paper and Father Pierre's address tonight is that when we look at issues of detention or accompaniment by soldiers, when refugees go to the hospital, we're sometimes looking at symbolic issues, but symbolic issues are no less important to the people concerned because they are symbolical. With regard to what Marcia had to say, I would also like to add that Dr. Faruja, at the end of her address 2 weeks ago, said she recommended that what was needed in Malta was more analysis of the kinds of stories refugees tell, why they tell those stories. And I think we've seen in Marcia's talk tonight the beginnings of an analysis, far more than the beginnings of an analysis, of what is involved in telling stories and projecting your identity outwards to the people in Malta if you are a refugee. And lastly, let me point forward. May I remind you that on 21st April, Dr. Adrian Grima will also be discussing, with reference to Maltese literature, the issue of racism and identity in Malta. And we're very grateful because on April 28th, Dr. Grima, with other members of the Mediterranean Creative Writing Project, will be organizing a round table session in this seminar series called Articulating the Clandestini Experience, Literary and Refugee Voices. So with those very preliminary remarks, let me now hand over to the audience.